welcomed the parents' perspective. Mr. Potter, the school principal, cleared his throat.
So glad you could be with us, Mrs. James.
Paula Jane, 6-year-old Tommy's mom, looked around the table nervously. In addition to the principal, the school guidance counselor, and a representative from the area school district were seated around her.
Thank you, she nodded. It will be good to work together on a plan for Tommy.
Yes, yes, Mr. Potter continued. So many youngsters beginning school these days. Puts quite a strain on the system. The school board cuts the budget and the resources just shrink, he grimaced.
Then he caught the eye of Sarah Johnson, the guidance counselor.
Well, Sarah, he began, what do you think we can do for this young man?
The counselor looked down at her open folder.
It says here that Tommy has some physical disabilities. Would he be able to play with the other kids, or is he confined to a wheelchair?
He can't really go on the equipment, Tommy's mom began.
But he'd love to have a chance to play with the other kids.
Yes, yes, Mr. Potter interrupted. But the school system is liable if anyone is injured, you know. Can't have kids in places where they might get hurt.
I understand that this school has a very good special ed class for kids with disabilities, added Bob Kettler, the area representative from the school district. What about putting Tommy in that class? I'm sure he'd succeed quite well in that kind of environment.
Yes, yes, Mr. Potter agreed. Good idea, Bob. What do you think, Sarah? Wouldn't Mrs. Clemens do a good job for him? That teacher always gets such raves from the special ed parents.
Wait! Paula almost shouted at them. Tommy's been in regular nursery school for 3 years. He's still going to physical therapy and is often slow with some tasks, but he can interact with the so-called normal kids. And, she was working hard to hold her emotions in check, I'd like him to have some special help with some things, but he deserves the chance to be in a regular classroom. He is, after all, she looked carefully at the faces around her, a little boy just beginning many years of school. I'd like him to see himself as capable.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about advocating for a child with disabilities? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has much experience to share with us in this area. Dr. Sari Horenstein is an historian and former PTA lecture program chair at the Ivy Mount School in Rockville, Maryland. She's a regular contributor to Washington Parent magazine and has devoted her efforts to exploring the mysteries of the special needs child. Her articles have addressed a diverse range of topics, including the theory of sensory integration, communication disorders, legal issues relating to special needs families, as well as the educational implications of No Child Left Behind for typically developing as well as special needs students. She's the mother of two boys, one an 18-year-old freshman at college, the other a 16-year-old with special needs. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Horenstein.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is the most important thing parents of disabled students should know?
What's the most important thing parents should know about children? And that's that they're not perfectible. This is true of typically developing children. It's true of kids with disabilities. You have to take them as they come. And part of the project of being a parent is to learn to appreciate what you've got, learn to appreciate where you might be able to take them, and learn to recognize that you cannot project far into the future because doing so would severely undermine the project of raising a child well.
I think we could stop right there. I think that was so profound. I don't know how we can get any better. When a child with a disability is just beginning school, how best can a parent get involved? We saw this little story, which is sort of a nightmare scenario, but what would you recommend for parents?
By the time your child is ready for school, you've discovered if the child has disabilities. And by then you have some idea about how the child learns, what difficulties that child may have motorically or perceptually. I can explain this a little more in a minute, but you already have some clear idea. So the best advice I can give to any parent whose child is entering school is to have a very clear idea of that child to the best of that parent's ability. And when you have an enormous amount of information that you can share in clear, simple terms, chances are you will have on board with you the teachers, the principals, and any other support staff that you're going to meet. It seems to me that an educated parent who really has tried to understand will do the best job of advocating on behalf of that child.
Like in so many other aspects of raising children, you have to do your homework.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. I think that's critical.
How do we prepare our child in these circumstances?
By helping them to understand what it means to recognize their limitations. We don't talk about them as limitations. I mean, if a child has difficulty writing and you need a slant board, for instance, or some sort of device that will make the pencil easier to wield, what you can do is simply empower this child by saying, you know, some people require crutches because they've broken a leg. You haven't broken a leg, but you have a little bit of difficulty positioning your wrist in an appropriate way. So we're going to send you to school with a slant board. No other child is going to have a slant board, most likely. But that doesn't really matter, does it? And you prepare the child to say, well, this is what I use, and it's the best thing for me. And you can argue it in a positive way, right? The reason you're using a slant board is because I like to have my posture better. So it doesn't sound like you've got a disability. Rather, it's an enhancement. Perhaps it will become regarded by other kids as a fashion accessory, and everybody's going to want to have slant boards, which probably would be a good thing, in fact. For me, as a parent of a child with a disability, my job is to raise my children well and to raise Alex well in this case. And I have a secondary job, but it's not really secondary. It's complementary. They work together. My job is also to educate everybody around me about Alex's disability. So, you know, when we talk about school accommodations and so on, some of these questions suggest that these are mainstreamable children. In my case, Alex was not mainstreamable for a variety of reasons. But I recall on one occasion, Alex and I went to the local co-op to shop. And when you go to the local co-op in our town, you can buy bulk. And so Alex and I went around with the wagon. He loved to push wagons, so he would push the wagon. And I tried to encourage him to help me scoop the bulk goods into a plastic bag. It's a little less expensive. It's, you know, it's a nice way to shop. Well, he wasn't interested in the scooping. He was interested in the nibbling. So he would open up various bins and just, you know, try a chocolate and a cracker. And there was a woman who followed me around. And there was a very clear sign in the co-op that said, please do not nibble. Scoop first and nibble later. So she said to me, sort of rather smartly, have you seen the sign? And I said, oh, yes, I have. Thank you for pointing it out. And I said to Alex, Alex, you mustn't nibble first. Let's scoop a few and pay, and then you can nibble. And she followed me around the store as he continued to nibble and scoop and fail to scoop. So we finally got to the checkout, and she said to me, I'm so sorry that I got in your way before. I hadn't realized how hard it was, and you're doing a beautiful job. So I thought, score one. But this has happened on many, many occasions where, you know, where I have had difficulties, you know, in the metro with Alex. And, you know, he's run up and down the halls. And, you know, some people have been very unhappy about his rambunctiousness, his inability to sit still, the noises he would make, and so on and so forth. And often people would, you know, sort of look at me, you know, askew and say, can't you get your child under control? And I've had this question many times in my long training period. I finally crafted an answer, which began to work rather well, which is, you know, I have thought of everything I could think of. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Could you help me out? Or else I would say something like, you know, it's funny. I've said all these things to him so many times. I wonder whether if you said it, he would listen a little better.
Wow.
And sometimes people would try, and sometimes people would clam up, and sometimes people would just sit back and recognize that this process of educating a child who is so loath to sit still, to hold himself in place, to keep his hands to himself, to stop wiggling and twisting and so on. That's the way he is. And, you know, maybe you just can't box him into this shape that people would feel a little more comfortable with. So my job has been to help Alex cope with the world and the variety of stimuli that come at him. At the same time, it's been my job to try and allow or to teach the community that he's part of it, and they have to learn how to accept him. So it seems to me that this applies in school, this applies on the metro, applies wherever you are. And so for many parents with children with disabilities, the strongest discomfort is the notion that you stand out like a sore thumb. But the fact of the matter is, you do. So once you recognize that fact, you then have to start making space for your son. There's got to be room for people like Alex and other children in this world. And if they don't know how to treat them or how to accept them, then you have to help them.
What you're doing is saying to the rest of the world, well, I'm vulnerable. Can you help me? Well, I have something that I'm dealing with. Maybe you can help me. But you're also saying, this is your responsibility too. You're saying to other people, where are you in here anyway? You know, and how are you going to participate? Which I think is brilliant. I mean, most people would not think to reply that way. So I'm really glad.
So I hope everyone,
that information.
I hope everyone out there who needs this is taking notes right away.
let me say, it doesn't always work.
We'll take a short break and be right back to continue our discussion on advocating for your child with disabilities.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Sari Hornstein about advocating for your child with disabilities.
Two summers ago, Alex and I went to the Norman Rockwell Museum. It's a wonderful museum, and we were going around the museum, he and I, together. And he's a bit of a bouncer. You probably caught that already. He sort of lopes from one space to the next. And we were looking at a picture by Norman Rockwell, which is probably well known to many people. It was a picture of the family of men, a Sikh and a rabbi and a priest, a white person and an Indian and a black person, all these people on a canvas. And underneath there was some sort of written comment about the family of men. And as I was looking at that picture, Alex loped two pictures over, and this woman turned to me in great irritation and said, "Can't you control your son?" And I said, "Well, I've tried." And I used my pat answer, which is, "I've tried everything in the book. Perhaps you'd like to remind him." And she says, "No, this is your responsibility. You're responsible for keeping your child under control in this museum, and he's interfering with my pleasure."
Oh my.
So I said, "You know, I'm sorry that you are discomforted by this young man. I'll do my best to keep him under control, but perhaps you have an opportunity to say something to him to help him understand that he needs to pay attention to you as well as to me." And she said, "No, that's your job." The person she was with was extremely embarrassed. But, you know, having said that I advocate for him and I argue the case that museums are not shrines and people ought to be able to walk and talk and move about, I was totally upended by this experience. And I kept Alex close by me. I said, "We are going to walk arm in arm right through the museum." I did not leave the museum. And when we finally left the museum, I crumpled. Wow. I said, "This is all you need. It's just, you know, we've had three fabulous days, you know, moving in this community, blah, blah, blah." And I was quite undone by this real insolent and irritated reaction. And, you know, I guess I realized some people simply aren't willing to try and look on the better side of things. And
how
I think
ironic
that
you were looking at a picture of the family of
that's
man.
That's why I bring it up.
We've talked about parents and we've talked about other adults in the communities, but we haven't talked about siblings. And I know you've had to deal with it yourself. How would you suggest that parents deal with this whole issue of the siblings? There's a business about empowering the siblings. There's a business about sensitizing the siblings. There's a business about helping the siblings to advocate for the child with disabilities and so on. What kinds of advice would you give?
I'll tell a story and it will become clear. I went to a party. I was invited with my husband and the children to a friend's party. It was a holiday party. So there were 10 children, you know, five couples, assorted children ranging in ages from about 13 to 2. And I had Alex and Eric with me. Eric is my older son. And Eric asked if he could go play with the older kids. And I said that was perfectly fine. Alex would stay with me and my husband, David. We would basically provide the Secret Service detail downstairs while the other kids played upstairs, because we had to watch Alex very carefully. And so I said we would cover Alex, no problem. And so Alex played with the younger set. He was about five and or four, and Eric was six, and in those age ranges. And we played it with the younger set. There were three or so, and the rest were upstairs sort of having a wild old time. And as we left the party, we got into the car to go back home, and Eric said to us, asked this question. He says, why is Alex so stupid? And, you know, it was clear that the kids who were there had never been exposed to a child like Alex, didn't understand what he represented, and just figured he was stupid. He couldn't move easily. He didn't have many words at the time. It was very hard for him to speak. And it was clear that he was quite awkward. And so I said to Eric, well, you know, Alex isn't stupid. These children just don't understand. They've never been exposed. So because they don't understand, they assume that he's stupid, but we know he's not. He's very clever. He knows how to get what he wants. He knows how to communicate with us because we know how to read what he's saying. And, you know, we don't understand why Alex is this way, but we know that he deserves our love and support, and what these children did was quite wrong. But they didn't do it because they were nasty or mean. They did it because they don't know, because they were ignorant of these kinds of situations. I felt like $1 million. I'd covered this, you know, I'd addressed this problem beautifully. And a few days later, we came back from winter holiday, and I went to see the psychologist who I've been working with for a very long time with Alex, who has basically been my constructive critic, right? She watches me interact with Alex ever since he was 2 years old and told me what I've been doing wrong, mm-hmm. or how I could do it better, or how I might try and get in there and sort of remove him from his tendency towards a kind of mentally isolated world. I guess I should say at some point that Alex is on the autism spectrum. So back to the story. I go to see this psychologist who's an absolutely wonderful psychologist who's also an important figure in the field of developmental issues. And I told her this story. And I was very proud of the way I'd handle it. She interrupted the session. She said, okay, is that all you said to Eric? I said, all? What else? She said. She said, well, I mean, how do you think he feels about Alex? And I said, well, I don't know. I didn't ask. And she wouldn't let this one go. She just, you know, she had an issue here, and I was totally in the dark. I had no idea what she was getting at. And finally she said to me, well, how do you feel about Alex? Well, I had kept all these emotions very strongly in check over a very long period of time. And I said, how do I feel about Alex? Well, I had a list. I feel angry, frustrated, depressed. I love him. I feel, you know, sort of anxious because I don't know how to help him. And I love him, and he's adorable, and he's sweet, and he's charming, and he can be funny. And I'm ashamed sometimes to take him places. And she said, oh, well, that's good to know. Why do you think Eric feels any differently? Mm-hmm. I said, well, you know, that's a good point, she said. She said to me, you know, he probably has that same range of emotions. Well, let me point out to you, she said, that when you and David are dead and gone, Eric will be the one person closest to Alex. Mm-hmm. How do you think he will take care of Alex if he's filled with resentment now? I was totally blindsided. I had no idea that I had left Eric so underserved. So the question is, how do you treat siblings? You treat them the same way you want to treat yourself when you're willing to admit that even though you face problems, even though you can be infuriated by somebody, even though you can resent some of their presence in your life, you can also still maintain a deep fund of love. This is true of any relationship. It's particularly true in this case. Mm.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on advocating for your child with disabilities.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 220015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Sari Hornstein about advocating for your child with disabilities.
When my first son was born, I was nervous beyond belief. I don't know why. I called up my yoga teacher, said, I can't come to class this morning. It was a prenatal yoga class. I just had the baby. So she wanted to know all about the baby. And I said, well, the baby was born and da-da-da-da-da. And I'm so nervous, I said, I've never had a son before. And she said, oh, that's all right. He's never had a mother.
Oh, what a great response.
Well, I was immediately relaxed. You're right.
Well, know.
We'll figure it out as we go along. That was my first son, Eric. I've used this. I've reminded myself of this anecdote many times with Alex, because there were times when I had no idea what was going on, but I thought I knew what was best, which leads me into self-advocacy. When he was 2 years old, I started working with a very gifted psychologist who is known as a play therapist. The notion is that you have to develop foundational skills in terms of interaction, in terms of learning how to communicate, connect with other people. All Alex would eat were noodles, only noodles, and noodles with as little flavor in them as possible. We walked into the session, and I had a box of noodles in a tin, sort of like a plastic container, and I said to Alex, would you like some noodles? And he said, yeah. And so he came over and took a noodle, and then he went back to play. And she said, what are you doing? So I said, oh, I'm just giving him his noodles. I just brought them in so that he would be able to eat some, because I just didn't want him to be hungry. So she said, she repeated the question again. She was one of these types who said, you know, who really believes that you have to figure it out. So I said, well, I brought them because he didn't finish them. Well, I gave him his breakfast at home, and then we got into the car because we had to come here. He hadn't finished it, so I had the noodles in the car with me. But he didn't finish the noodles in the car, so I figured I'd bring them in here. I'd hate to throw out food, so I brought him the noodles. And she said again, what do you think you're doing? So I said, got me. I don't know. She says, who are you anyway? Fairy godmother? He's going to fall down in the playground. You're going to pick him up. Somebody's going to come and bully him. You're going to interfere. You're going to feed him at 12 o'clock at night when he's hungry and he's 18. Tell me, what are you doing running interference for this child all the time? Let him speak. Give him a schedule. Let him figure out how to articulate what he needs and what he wants, and help him to grow into an independent little schlepper. Alex had a disability. It was my job as a parent to put him right, to fix him. I was going to give him the food he needed. I was going to give him the encouragement. I was going to get on the floors. I was going to do everything in my power to bring him up and make him right, make him normal, make him mainstreamable, all this stuff. This was such a high motivating factor. And this was where I stood to be corrected, big time. Well, you can't make him other than what he is. What you can do is begin to understand who he is, and listen, and learn, and when he's withdrawn, find a way to get in. I had no idea what she was talking about.
But she didn't want you to follow him around with
his noodles. I was doing everything. I mean, if I could prop him up and get his legs to move, I would do that too. I was hopelessly committed to the notion that if I just worked hard enough and put enough energy into this process, he would be fine. And this was basically a very wrong idea, and it's very counterproductive, because what it does is it fails the parent, because the parent never really quite appreciates what's unique and special about that child.
Dr. Sari Hornstein, we are so grateful to have had you with us, and obviously there's so much to cover that we're going to have this in a second show as well. So we hope our listeners will tune in next week to be able to hear yet another part of this important information. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And mention show number 235. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you are tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.